Hello, Player One. Welcome to the Gaming History Club. My name is Gabby.
Hello, and I'm JP. In today's episode, we explore the exciting and sometimes weird legal cases of the video game industry.
Okay, JP, probably when people hear legal cases, they will think to themselves, boring.
Snooze fest,
yeah. But I think when you know how much money it involves in all of these legal cases and what it impacts, how it impacts people in video game industry, they will probably be quite interested in this.
It's a side of the video game industry that I want to take a blind eye towards, because we don't want to hear about the dollar ching ching, do we?
Yeah.
But undoubtedly it's a big part of the gaming industry.
Yeah, so according to Statista.com, in 2024, the video games market is projected to reach a revenue of $282 billion. So it is a big industry on its own.
Massive.
Yeah, and a large amount of legalities and lawsuits surrounding the video game industry relate to money, such as copyright, profiteering, and antitrust laws, which seek to prohibit anti-competitive conduct. And the industry is big business, as we've established before, and various groups seek to protect and increase their profits. Not only game developers, not only game publishers, I think everyone try to make money from video games, left, right, center.
Yeah, you can just imagine someone rubbing their greedy hands in the background here, can't you? With wearing a suit like...
Where can I make money?
Yeah,
exactly. On the other hand, the industry encounters the law often from a social angle as well, such as the depiction of adult themes in video games and minimizing exposure to non-adults. Lawsuits that attempt to improve accessibility in video games and potential to be addictive. These are two overly generalized ways that the industry and the law interact with each other. More often than not, financial and social aspects are both played out within lawsuits, and video games are susceptible to being politically weaponized, adding yet another layer. So, JP, what was the first lawsuit that happened in video games industry?
Yeah, so the first lawsuit, it's not actually super common knowledge because it's not super impactful in the bigger scheme of things. But let's take a look at the very, very first lawsuit that we could find, according to our research. The first ever lawsuit appears to be a copyright infringement claim brought by Allied Leisure Industries against Midway for allegedly copying a circuit board drawing in the fall of 1973. So that's just a year after Pong was released, to give you an idea of how early and quick the first ever lawsuit came. It's a lesser-known case that has been expertly researched by Professor William K. Ford, and we'll leave a link in the description. He uses the case to shed insight into the landscape of copyright law at the very beginning of the industry. He concludes in his research paper stating that this first case illustrates the challenge the early video game industry faced in protecting its investments. And yet at the same time, it wasn't clear that the industry actually needed more protection. He says that the lack of effective protection under the copyright and unfair competition laws may have promoted the quick establishment of the industry, facilitating the easy entry of many arcade game manufacturers in the video game business without the need to negotiate with Atari. Future innovation, however, likely required more protection than what was available under the patent or other laws. But what was the first major lawsuit? The first major case will be familiar to longtime Player One listeners. This is when Magnavox, the company behind the first home video game console, the Magnavox Odyssey, sued Atari and several other competitors. This includes the likes of Mattel, Seaberg, and Activision. Everyone who made a Pong clone basically was sued by Magnavox, and this was for infringing on their copyright to table tennis, or better known as Pong.
Ooh, that's technical, Dad. So Pong, table tennis.
Or tennis for two.
Or tennis for two.
In my eyes, it'll always be tennis for two. But according to the mastermind behind the first home console, Ralph Baer, the Magnavox company consciously waited to start its massive slew of lawsuits until April 1974. And they did this to allow Atari and all the other game manufacturers to generate more profits. Thereby, by the time that they sued them, they could generate more profits from the lawsuits. Magnavox was very successful suing these companies for copyright infringement, and they did this until as late as the 90s, and it only stopped because the patent finally expired by then, making more than $100 million in the process, which is more than the Magnavox Odyssey itself actually made.
Yeah, so they made more by lawsuits than by the games, basically.
Yeah, but just a quick disclaimer here, Player One, before we start judging, no pun intended, any of these companies, let's just keep in mind, this was the Wild West. There was no established video game precedence in law. Everyone was suing each other. And you will come to find this out yourself as we progress in today's episode.
So how did Magnavox manage to sue a lot of these companies? It all lays on their patent language. The table tennis patent used very broad language. The first one, apparatus for generating symbols upon the screen of a television receiver to be manipulated by at least one participant, comprising number two, means for generating a hitting symbol, and number three, means for generating a hit symbol, including means for ascertaining coincidence between said hitting symbol and said hit symbol, and means for imparting a distinct motion to said hit symbol upon coincidence. Whew, you know what? I do not understand that, actually.
This does not sound like Pong to me whatsoever. I wouldn't even be able to imagine what this concept is trying to be. So yes, incredibly broad language.
Yeah, and that's no surprise then that Magnavox managed to use this patent language to bring other companies to the court.
Yeah, absolutely. A bit of a smart move, if I'm being honest. This broad patent language, I mean, it certainly helped them sue all these companies, right?
Yeah, so, and get money from it. So, yeah. Hey, fair to them. So, in 1985, Nintendo attempted to invalidate the patents by arguing that the game existed as prior art since William Higginbotham created the true first version of Pong on an oscilloscope back in 1958. That's way back before video games were available to the public. However, the court ruled that release 1958 Tennis for Two was not a video game as it did not use video signals.
Yeah, crazy. So obviously it's an oscilloscope, so a very analog machine that's been rigged in a way to be able to play this game, but it's not, I guess, a quote-unquote video game?
Yeah, so you know what, it's a fair point that the judge ruled because it's very technical when it comes to patent language, basically.
I mean, the judges, to just like anyone else in the world, video games was a brand new thing, like no one knows anything. The only thing you can use is technicalities at this point to try and draw distinction, right?
Exactly.
But since we are on the topic of patenting, let me tell you about these so-called patent troll companies that exist. So they obtain the rights to one or more patents in order to profit by means of licensing or litigation, rather than by producing its own goods or services. Basically, these guys, they buy patents and then sue companies. Even though they're not making games themselves, they'll like buy gaming patents, right? And then sue other companies for infringing on those patents. They never made a game themselves using any of these patents, though. Patent trolling. Never heard of this before the research of this episode. The size and financing of these patent trolls can force and scare smaller developers especially to submit to these demands, even if they feel confident a court of law would side with them. Due to the intense cost and resources required to fight these cases in court, though, they often favor with larger corporations in the end. Video games have had a lot of patent trolling issues, as many other tech industries do as well. And we've got some crazy examples that we can share with you as well, Player One. But you'll have to stay tuned for now for further episodes of Gaming History Club, because for the sake of the length of this episode, we will leave that for another day. General patenting of video game concepts is super normal though, and legitimate game developers patent many of their ideas.
So let's talk about a few patenting examples. Do you know Crazy Taxi, JP?
I think you know Crazy Taxi better than I do.
Yeah, probably that's true. Yeah. But yeah, you know those arrow navigation system in Sega's Crazy Taxi back from 99? Apparently that's patented. 2 years later, Sega would sue Fox when their game The Simpsons Road Rage used an identical system, switching an arrow for a finger. The case was settled out of court at the end of the day.
Wow, so just that arrow that tells you which direction to drive in, yeah, to drop off your passenger.
Yeah, just that.
Wow, no way that was patented. That's such a common thing these days, yeah? I mean, different versions now, but like now we've got radar and like a similar, like a GPS kind of thing, yeah? On your radar to tell you where to go, or sometimes arrows on the streets. But like that arrow to just tell you where to go in Crazy Taxi, that's quite surprising that that's patented, yeah? It comes to show how confident and probably proud of this idea Sega was to say, oh my God, this arrow navigation system, let's patent that. That is a brilliant idea.
Let me tell you, Sega, I would say that other maps or direction system that other games are using, kind of better than the arrow thing.
Yeah, but would they exist without the original creation from Sega and Crazy Taxi?
That we need to answer another day, I guess. But yeah, another one, in 1995, Namco patented loading screen games and appears to have made deter developers about potential patenting lawsuits if they should add similar minigames during their loading screens. Namco did not, however, invent the idea. The first game to do this appeared to be Skyline Attack for the Commodore 64 from back in 1984. The patent expired in 2015. Another one that I want to mention today is BioWare. They patented the dialogue wheel as shown in their game Mass Effect from back in 2007. That's another one that made me think as well, like, other games using dialogue, are they using like the same wheel system? Then I realized, actually, no, not really.
Yeah, so I think specifically with the dialogue wheel, it's the moving of the analog stick into a certain direction to choose an answer. Mm-hmm. But I think even more than that, it's the fact that, like, at least for a part of the game, it's consistent in terms of, like, what you say is different, but, like, the top left might be, like, the good option to use. Mm-hmm. And then the top right might be the evil one. And then the bottom left might be, like, the intelligent questioning answer that you can give and so on. So I think that's specifically what they patented, the consistency in the direction.
Interesting. Yeah. Well, so let's move on to talk about our next case. So this involves two company giants, really. This is between Universal versus Nintendo. In 1983, Universal attempted to sue Nintendo for what they felt was trademark infringement. Universal claimed that they owned the rights to King Kong, and Nintendo's 1981 game Donkey Kong was a trademark infringement. What do you think about this, Player One?
Yeah, what do you think about this, Player One? If you feel anything like me, you probably think to yourself, that's a little bit ridiculous, but we have such a ingrained like idea of what Donkey Kong and King Kong are nowadays. But I mean, take yourself back to when it was just King Kong that existed since the 30s, and all of a sudden, Donkey Kong comes along, you know, also stealing a female damsel in distress and climbing some type of construction, yeah.
Yeah.
But I think this isn't where the real scandal comes from, right?
No, definitely not. So the president of Universal at the time, Sid Sheinberg, was also a seasoned attorney and was looking for a way to get Universal involved and profit in the video game industry. Instead, he started suing companies who he believed were infringing on Universal trademarks. Universal's methods were quite brute, especially since they don't actually own the full rights to King Kong themselves. King Kong actually has a long history of issues regarding ownership, and it involves a long-fought battle from the original creator, Marion Cooper. To re-establish his rights over the character, King Kong is in part public domain and owned by various different groups. This was the main defense stance adopted by Nintendo, and the judge ruled in Nintendo's favor and had some very harsh words for Universal too. So, here's what the court ruled. Universal knew that it did not have trademarks rights to King Kong, yet it proceeded to broadly assert such rights anyway. This amounted to a wanton and reckless disregard of Nintendo's rights. It embarked on a deliberate, systematic campaign to coerce all of Nintendo's third-party licensees to either stop marketing Donkey Kong products or pay Universal royalties. Well, as we can see here, Universal's conduct amounted to an abuse of judicial process and in that sense caused a longer harm to the public as a whole. Universal's assertion in court were based not on any good faith belief in their truth, but on the mistaken belief that it could use the courts to turn a profit. Universal was made to pay a fine to Nintendo as well as its legal costs of $1.8 million. Nintendo's attorney, Howard Lincoln, hired John Kirby to represent Nintendo during the court proceedings. Nintendo was so happy with the outcome of the lawsuit, they thanked John with a $30,000 sailboat named Donkey Kong, which is really cute.
Burn.
With exclusive worldwide rights to use the name for sailboats. I find that really cute, actually. Also, they named the titular Kirby character and games after him. Oh, I really hope that doesn't mean that John Kirby was eating everything that's around him.
Well, that's actually, that didn't come along until the second Kirby game. Did you know that? Like in the first one, he didn't eat up and take on the enemy's abilities. That's actually in the
second one.
Yeah.
But yeah, the outcome was extremely important for Nintendo, who with Donkey Kong tried to break into the American video game market. And this court case could have severely hindered their success.
Let's look at another very big, majorly impactful video game lawsuit case. This one is Atari versus Philips. So Atari had acquired the license from Namco and Midway to produce a version of the arcade hit Pac-Man for their own home console, the Atari 2600. Around the same time, Philips created a very, very similar game. You might even call it a clone or complete ripoff of Pac-Man. And they called it KC Munchkin, released in 1981, for the Magnavox Odyssey 2. At the time, this was one of the few cases that sided with the defendant, based on the fact that idea expression distinction that copyright does not protect broad ideas, only the unique expression. In the case of Pac-Man and Munchkin, the court would need to examine the audio-visual elements of Pac-Man and determine which parts counted as protectable forms of expression. So what does that mean in effect? The case set an important precedent. Atari could not prevent game manufacturers and developers from general gameplay ideas, such as chasing characters, scoring, dots, or moving around in a tunnel. However, copyright protection can be granted to non-essential elements, such as the actual character of Pac-Man. The court noted 22 similarities and 9 differences between Pac-Man and KC Munchkin. Essentially, Philips lost the case and the game was forced off the market. However, Philips released a sequel called KC's Crazy Chase. In a tongue-in-cheek move by Philips, they redesigned the enemy characters to resemble the antagonist of Atari's Centipede game, directly letting the court case influence their game design. They also redesigned the movement of Munchkin to roll through the mazes without the infamous Pac-Man chomping motion, you know, the waka 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 waka, to avoid further lawsuits. This case helped to clearly draw distinctions in the legal sense of what can and cannot be copied. So, general gameplay elements? No, that's fine for everyone to incorporate in their game.
Yeah, that's true.
But not specific non-general gameplay elements, such as the character of Pac-Man himself. Someone cannot just use a resemblance or clone of Pac-Man in that game. But yeah, super interesting because, I mean, this is a massive deal, right? This actually now draws the difference, the distinction, what mm-hmm. can and cannot be done. And before this case, it was, like I said earlier, a bit of a Wild West, actually. Now, let's talk a little bit about reverse engineering. And I'm going to have to go and give you quite a backstory on this one, but it's a really, really interesting backstory. And we're going to go through some really interesting gaming history stuff here. The Atari 2600 is released in 1977, and obviously it needed programmers to make more games for their system, and they hired plenty of them. But not all employees at Atari were happy with the way they were treated. For example, Atari did not credit their programmers publicly, and they did this apparently to prevent the programmers from being recruited by some of their competitors, right? Atari also didn't award bonuses to those that developed exceptionally profitable games for the company. One of these programmers was David Crane. He was such former employee who found that he was fully responsible for making games that brought in more than $20 million for Atari. However, he was still only receiving a $20,000 salary.
That's bad.
Yeah. So apparently they found this out because there was a memo coming out from Atari themselves mm-hmm. to kind of, you know, show the sales figures of their games. And this was to help the programmers get a sense of what direction to take their games and to see, well, what was popular.
Yeah, and what games work.
Yeah, exactly, right? Atari announced that they made $100 million in cartridge sales in this memo. So David Crane, together with three other employees, Kaplan, Miller, and Whitehead, realized that out of the entire development department, which consisted of 35 people, these four programmers accounted for 60% of Atari sales, and they are not getting any bonuses towards that. Just keep that in mind, right? So what do the four programmers do? Well, they decide to start their own business and make their own video games. They became the first independent third-party console video game developer, Activision.
Well, no wonder Atari was extremely annoyed at Activision, to say the least, resulting in a lawsuit that alleged violation of non-disclosure agreements and trade secrets, attempting to prevent Activision from creating games for the Atari. Bear in mind, up until this point, only console makers created games for their own consoles. The case was settled out of court in 1982, and it was agreed that Activision was able to make games for the console if they paid royalties. It's basically set up precedent of how we do it in modern-day gaming, how game developers do now. They make games, they pay royalties to the console maker. So Activision made majorly successful games for the Atari and largely supported the success of Atari overall. It enabled other game developers and companies to develop games without requiring to make their own console. The Atari game market was now open. Soon after, the video game market saw rapid growth. In 1982, the number of Atari 2600 games on the market rose from just 100 to over 400 games. This caused a huge influx of poorly developed, rushed, and unlicensed games to be produced because they're produced by companies attempted to cash in on the growing video game market, causing the 1983 video game crash. For a while, it looked like the video game hype was kind of over. But probably not really, because around at the same time, Nintendo was still very focused and invested to breaking out into American video game market and planning to release their Famicom, or NES, in America. And to avoid the same fate that occurred to Atari, they developed a lockout chip that would only allow games licensed by Nintendo themselves to be playable on their console. This allowed them to control the terms under which third-party game developers were allowed to release games for the NES, including limiting the number of games a company releases for the console per year to only 2 games and limiting inappropriate content. Atari lost much of its glory by 1986, hurt from the video game crash. The tables had turned, and Atari created a subsidiary called Tengen to produce third-party games for the NES instead. Atari attempted to reverse-engineer Nintendo's lockout chip in order to make game cartridges, bypassing the need to get officially licensed by Nintendo. By monitoring communications between the console and cartridge chips, chemically peeling layers from the chip, and microscopically examining the code embodied in the chip's silicon. Although Atari failed in their efforts to reverse engineer Nintendo's lockout system and negotiated a license deal with Nintendo instead, that didn't really stop Atari from trying though. They continued to reverse engineer the lockout chip, and in 1988, they even tasked one of their lawyers to falsely make a claim with the Copyright Office, claiming that they required Nintendo's lockout chip source code to help with litigation in a law case. But there was no law case. This was just a ruse, basically. And Atari used this copy in order to develop their own replica and named it the Rabbit. Well, as you probably can already predict here, both companies would end up suing each other, Atari against Nintendo for unfair competition, and Nintendo against Atari for infringing on their patent and copyright. What a mess, right?
What an absolute mess, yes. Another case very important to reverse engineering was Sega versus Accolade in 1992. Similar to Nintendo, Sega also created their own lockout chip to prevent unlicensed games from being played on their console, the Sega Genesis. To get around licensing their games with Sega, Accolade purchased a Sega Genesis to decompile the executable code of three Genesis games and use it to program their new cartridges in a way that would allow them to disable the security lockouts. This was done successfully to Accolade's 1990 game Ishido, The Way of Stones. For one of Sega's revised Genesis consoles released in 1990, the Genesis Mark III, a new variation was used. When a game cartridge was now inserted into the console would check for a string Sega at a particular point in the memory of the cartridge. If it was found, it would allow the game to run, and also, it would now display a message produced by or under license from Sega. They did this in order to enable potential future lawsuits if required. And they made complete use of this tactic soon after, when in 1991, Sega filed lawsuit against Accolade. Accolade argued that their use of Sega's material constituted fair use. However, the judge did not see eye to eye with Accolade, since they were a game manufacturer making a financial game, and their games also competed directly with Sega's licensed games. So initially, Sega won the case, and the judge issued an injunction that would prohibit sales by Accolade for its unlicensed games. But Accolade appealed a week after the court ruling. Ultimately, during the appeal, the judge ruled in Accolade's favor, and the two companies would eventually settle out of court, and Accolade became an official licensee of Sega. There is quite a lot of content around the judge's ruling, which Player One you can look up, but let me warn you, it makes for quite dry reading if I'm being honest, and we chose to gloss over it a little bit just for the sake of the length of this episode. The case Sega vs. Accolade, however, had a large impact on the industry and has been an influential case in matters revolving around reverse engineering of software and copyright infringement. It set a precedent, and it's been cited in numerous cases since 1993. Reverse engineering video games was legally okay. Further cementing reverse engineering as legal was a case held around the same time, also in 1992, when the creators of the Game Genie cheating cartridge, Louis Galoop Toys. The Game Genie, by the way, it allowed for cheat codes to be applied to games before starting them. So they initiated a lawsuit against Nintendo, seeking declaratory judgment that they are legally allowed to sell the Game Genie. And they did this to take proactive measures against Nintendo, potentially interfering with their business. They could basically sense Nintendo around the corner wanting to kind of, yeah, it's unlicensed, but it's not technically a game. It's a cheating cartridge, right? So you put that in before you start the game to enable some cheat codes, you know, playing Zelda, infinite lives. So it's not an official cheat code in the game. You just kind of apply the cheat to the game, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, they kind of had brilliant vision and they knew Nintendo was going to come after them. So they sought this declaratory judgment, basically. And they won as well, which enabled them to sell the game Genie moving forward without any hassle from lawsuits.
Good on them.
So, we discussed a lot of cases today, Player One, and we've barely scraped the tip of the iceberg. There are many super interesting cases, and we will be revisiting this topic in future, so stay tuned for more legal fights. But we hope you enjoyed our brief overview of some of the more important legal cases that we touched on today.
Yep, and as usual, new episodes of Gaming History Club are released every second Wednesday, so make sure you subscribe and follow us on our social media. Say hi to us by visiting our website, gaminghistory.club, and let us know what topics you'd like to hear, or simply share your favorite video game stories with us.
Come back in a couple of weeks, Player One, and remember to put on your tracksuit, because we're going to get sporty. See ya.